Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, Heritage Radio listeners, and welcome to Season 5 of The Line. It's 2018. We're back. You probably already broke your New Year's resolution. You're dreaming of warmer weather, but fear not. We've got your distraction right here. We're back broadcasting live from the back garden of the famous Roberta's Pizza, adjacent to the 2-Michelin-star Blanca, bringing you another season of delicious interviews with unique chefs and restaurateurs, all great talents in the food world. I mentioned Blanca because my guest today is a veteran of that kitchen, so he had no trouble finding Heritage Radio Studios since he worked about 100 feet away for a while. Chef Greg Prochel is the executive chef of Ferris, a new restaurant located in the Maid Hotel in the Nomad area of Manhattan. The restaurant, which just recently opened only a few months ago, was just given 2 stars by the New York Times. Pete Wells wrote in his review, "It's a modest restaurant that over-delivers, cares about little details, and has a personal, handmade sensibility." Prochel has worked at 11 Madison Park, Graffiti, and Blanca, where he was sous under Carlo Maracci when the restaurant earned its 2nd Michelin star. Prior to opening Ferris, he was the executive chef at La Turtle in Manhattan. That restaurant was named one of Eater's best new restaurants of 2016. Today we're going to discuss Michelin stars, Sasso chickens, economics, and cooking for every single conceivable hotel service, all out of the tiny basement kitchen. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start at the way beginning. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Westwood, New Jersey. So right outside, about 25 minutes outside George Washington Bridge.
So pretty close to here.
Absolutely.
What was life like as a kid? Were you one of the families that came into Manhattan a lot, or was Manhattan was it 1,000 miles away as far as
no,
you were concerned?
I mean, we definitely came in a lot. We basically came in all the time to eat. Peter Luger's definitely is one of the places that I spent a lot of time. My grandfather grew up in Brooklyn after emigrating from Germany, and we spent a lot of time there. I've been there more times than I'd like to say. So I pretty much always have come in for food. I mean, that's kind of a theme I think that's run my whole life, is that I do everything for food. I mean, I live to eat, so.
Luger's is a good place to go as a kid. It's got a lot of excitement because it's got the old waiters with like the old uniforms, like these 70-year-old guys that have never changed, and then you've got sizzling hot steaks coming through. So as a little kid, did you have any inclination, even when you were, you know, very, very young, going there with your grandparents and your parents, that this might be a career for you?
It's funny. I don't. I mean, I wanted to play for the New York Jets. That was my dream growing up. And I played football for a very long time. But, you know, at one point, I think I realized that it would never happen. I don't want to say that I knew I was going to do it. I just knew that food was a big part of my life. And I knew it was always going to be a big part of my life. But, I mean, as a young child, I think I always got just immersed in it. I mean, my grandparents we would go into the city with, they were phenomenal cooks. I mean, every single good memory has been a food memory of my life, pretty much. Always circling around family, food, and they were drinking. I wasn't until I was able to. And then
before you were able
to. Yeah, that's probably right. And a lot of loud talking.
Were they cooking German food, actual flavors from their childhood?
Not really. I think more of things they accumulated, because like I said, my grandfather, they moved here with my grandmother. They moved here when he was 21 and she was 18. Very young. They lived in Brooklyn. They had five kids there, one being my mother. I think they picked up a lot of influences just from people around. I mean, a lot of Italian influences. I mean, like, but like my favorite dish of all time that my grandfather makes is clams oreganato, which is definitely nothing close to German. But they use a lot of different techniques, I think, they picked up from their childhood. And then especially my great grandmother, who I was fortunate enough to know until I was 14. She cooked a lot of traditional German stuff. Not many things that I remembered. I just remembered a lot of stuffed cabbage, which was one of my favorites. And she was a great baker.
And so, besides the cooking, was it a creative household that you grew up in with your parents? I'm always curious when we have chefs on the program, like, what fuels that creativity? Sometimes it's very obvious, and other times it's a little more subtle. For you, was it a house where sort of creativity and ingenuity was rewarded, or was it more like analytical, go to school, get a degree?
Well, that's funny you say that. My dad, very much sports, analytics, like, do business. He was a stockbroker. Like, he wanted me just to do business. My mom, on the other hand, was very much the creative, like, the drive for me. I mean, I always drew. I still draw to this day a lot. And I was probably the biggest Lego collector in all of New Jersey growing up. So, like, I always knew that, like, I liked building stuff. Always I wanted to use my hands. I play musical instruments. Like, I think I always have had to find a way to express myself creatively. But to say that I was surrounded by creativity, I don't know. I mean, my sister was very much like books, like very book, like she's a lawyer now. So she's followed that passion very, very strictly. But I was always I always wanted to run around. I always wanted to play outside. I always wanted to do stuff. School, I never wanted to do ever. I just was lucky enough to do well at it without having to try too hard, I guess. But yeah, I mean, mine was always just, I wanted to do stuff all the time. I never wanted to really sit around. And it's funny because now that's kind of all I want to do is sit around and read books and like read cookbooks and research cuisines. I mean, besides being at work. So
you mentioned that, you know, your parents are kind of opposites and you're a blend.
Much.
And, you know, the school choice that you made, you went to Wesleyan, which I think veers a little bit towards what you're saying about your mom. It's a small liberal arts college in Connecticut, but you studied economics.
I did.
Which is an interesting choice for Wesleyan and for someone who's just described themselves as wanting to use their hands and build things. Economics is really, it was a lot of pen and paper and computer, right?
Very much so. I mean,
so why that choice?
Well, I mean, math was always also very interested. I'm actually very interested in numbers. I think like number theory is very cool. And like at the end of the day, most businesses, all it is really numbers. I mean, at any business anywhere. It was a very dad conversation. It was more like, oh, I want to take a minor in architecture. Like, I really like earth and environmental sciences. And he's like, you should probably do economics. And I was like, well, you know, I'm really interested in this other stuff. And he's like, you should probably do economics. And I was like, well, all right, I guess I'll do economics then. And I'm very happy for that because it gave me a really good business sense. And I think that's very important. Yeah, and granted, I did have an office job for like 2.5 years after college. Every moment of it, I really disliked every single moment.
What did you do?
I was an analyst for a while.
Okay.
And I mean, so it was like a lot of Excel work, which is great because still in this industry, I mean, I do have to use Excel. I have to do inventory. I have to do all my scheduling. I mean, like, I'm very comfortable with it, so I'm very happy that I have that stuff. But I mean, especially like the last 6 months of working in the collared and tie world, I really was just, it was just like, all right, I got 6 months. I'm going to go to culinary school. Like, I got to get out of this. I got to get out.
It's interesting that you mention, you know, the Excel documents because people work at restaurants and they learn how to do knife skills. You learn how to manage your prep list. You learn how to just generally stay organized, right? Pick up dishes, how to make a sauce that doesn't break. No one really tells you that once you become the executive chef, once you become in charge, you sit at a computer for a really long time, for long periods of the week.
More than you'd like.
More than anyone really likes. And a lot of it comes down to just managing inventory, managing schedules and things like that. Did you always feel like you had like a leg up from going to school, or did you feel behind when you went to ICE? Did you feel ahead or behind?
I was an old cook. I mean, I was 26 when I started cooking. So that's, in the grand scheme of things, that's pretty old. I am very competitive, so like I didn't really think I was a leg down that I started late. It's just, you know, it's interesting going into a job and having someone that's like 7-8 years younger than you just like literally destroying you around the kitchen and just feeling very inadequate. That's how I felt. I mean, my first job, like you mentioned, was at EMP. That was the first time I went to stage there to graduate. And
really threw yourself into the fire.
Yeah,
on that one.
Yeah. I decided to start slow.
I'll go somewhere. I'll go to EMP, one of the best restaurants in the world.
I went there to stage so I could get unpaid for an externship. And that was the first time stepping foot inside a professional kitchen. So that was eye-opening. I mean, immediately when I stepped into that kitchen and just seeing the things around me, seeing how it actually functioned, I was like, yeah, I was like, this is for me. And then I actually got picked when I started my externship, because that was a few weeks before. I think maybe 5 or 6 days before it, they got their first 4-star review. So I walked into that, and from that stage being like, this is what I want to do. The first 2 weeks there, I was like, oh God, I've made the biggest mistake of my life. Like parts of my body hurt that I didn't know I had. I just was going down every single day. And then, you know, it got easier. And then a month went by, like, yeah, I'm better. And then, you know, you start progressing, you start finding your footing. And it was a very great first job. I mean, if anyone's going to kick your ass like that, I'd rather it be them. So
your perspective on EMP is something that I want you to share a little bit more in terms of specifics. I am really curious about, you know, prep work and cleaning. I think a lot of listeners, have experience in kitchens, right? But not many people know, they can't really see what that level of excellence is like up at the top. And you came in sort of from an outside perspective. You were a little bit older than anyone else, probably very, you know, mature, but had very little experience. So, you know, in terms of the workload, if you can share specifics, what was a day like in a 4-star kitchen for your first job?
Well, I don't want to say depressing, because that's the wrong word, but you literally feel like I felt like I was letting people down every single day, just because I was never ready. The first couple of weeks, I was never ready for service. I was always behind. I was always doing stuff wrong. But luckily I had, the gentleman who, Chris Flynn, was the first sous chef I have. He's a big reason of why I was there. He really knew how to like drive me, and he really knew, like, he was like the dad. He was like, I'm not mad, but I'm disappointed, which is like, I think one of the most powerful things.
The worst.
Yeah, it's
a hard thing to hear.
The worst. And, you know, and he's like, you could be better. And like, you know, and at first I was just like, no, I can't be better. And then you start believing in him, and you start having all this positive influence, and you have all these people around you. Cause at the end of the day, you know, the thing I love about the kitchen is it is like, I've played sports my whole life. It is a team. It is, everyone's working towards one goal, and you know, you are as good as your weakest link. And like, I didn't want to be the weakest link. And I was at the beginning. I mean, I absolutely was. So I had to work hard. I had to get better. And I mean, you're basically, what it's like, the prep list is, you're coming in, you have 4 hours to get 7 or 8 hours of work done. So you just have to get better. I mean, it was a sink or swim situation. I mean, with like I said, there's so much positive support there, but at the same time, is if you're not pulling your weight, you know, like people will notice it. So you don't want to be that guy or girl. Like you want to be a positive like influence on everyone around you. And like, I always saw myself as, if I didn't know what I was doing, I'm going to figure out how to do it. I'm going to stay up late. I'm going to look at videos. I mean, like, luckily we have that now. Like, I'm going to find ways to get better. I'm going to ask questions. I'm going to come in early, off the clock. I'm going to do what I can, just because I always wanted to get better. And that's kind of why I chose that, because I knew I was coming in late. I knew I wanted to start at one of the best restaurants in the world, because I wanted to accelerate quick. I mean, I wanted to get to where I am, so. But in terms of like one, a lot of the first, like interactions I've had with sous chefs there were them telling me I'm doing something wrong. Like James Kent, I joked about it with him the other day when I saw him, that I was like, the first time you talked to me was when you yelled at me because I had some flour at the floor. Like I was doing these crab cakes and there was like flour, like panko breadcrumbs on the floor, and he just was screaming at me. And you know, he's right, it was dirty. But like I was like, it's funny because that's your first interaction, and like then like, you know, but then he saw I was doing good, and then it's like we have good interactions. It's just, it's like there's a very it's a tough love, but it's like at the same time it's his love. I mean, like they want you there. They want you to do well.
How did you come across Blanca? It's another high-end restaurant, but perhaps as different from EMP as you can get while still being in the Michelin system. For people who have never been to either one, 11 Madison Park, large dining room, at least probably 100 seats, soaring ceilings, white chef coats, very, very classic. Blanca, tell us about Blanca. What's Blanca like?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny because like until I went to EMP, not since high school, did I have to be cleanly shaven every day. It was very important that I had to be cleanly shaven. And like from anyone who has seen my picture, I am a very, very, very bearded man.
Yeah.
Shaving every day sucks. It's rough. Like it's irritating, especially when you're wearing a chef's coat on your neck. It's like, I don't want to go into the specifics, but it's like,
it's
uncomfortable.
It's
uncomfortable. Yeah. It's like, I don't like having a rash on my neck while I'm getting absolutely punished with prep. But Blanca, timing's everything. It's very serendipitous. After EMP, you know, I had a great job at Graffiti where I worked with Jesus Nunez, who was a big mentor. He honed my creativity and really like believed in me. He was one of the first chefs I believed in, like just letting me kind of go. And then after that, I chased money, which is, you know, not a smart thing to do as a young cook. And then one day, my girlfriend at the time took me to a Terra for my birthday, which was an amazing meal. And I was like, I want to do this. Like I want to do tasting menu. Like this was like such a special experience that really changed, like really kind of changed my whole. Like kind of just general outlook on like what food could be. And I literally quit my job a couple days later and I was kind of just searching, and I answered a random ad, and then I was at my parents' house at the time, and I got a text message from Carlo just being like, can you come into stage? Can you come in tomorrow? And I literally came back from New Jersey, staged there. He's like, come back in a week. I staged there again a week, and then I got the job. And at the same time, as I was off the Michelin, you know, that racket for a little while. So the first couple days were tough. My good buddy Alex Leonard, who was the CDC after there, he was tough on me right in the beginning. And then because of that, we forged a really good friendship. And I mean, we did amazing things there. But it's funny because we didn't take ourselves very seriously. I mean, we took our work extremely seriously. I mean, when we were there, it went from, I believe, 6 people down to 2, like almost overnight. And just me and Alex and all you guys there. And like, we didn't panic. We just kind of did our thing. We did it at our pace. We did it at a level that we love. I mean, it's such an amazing place there. Like Blanca was, it opened my eyes to the Green Market. I was going to the Green Market 4 times a week. I was learning about ingredients. I was seeing techniques. It was like a cuisine without, you know, without like reins. It was just, we could do kind of whatever we wanted as long as it was within Carlo's vision. And he really wanted us to express ourselves through our food and through his vision. So I can't say this that truthfully because I haven't been to too many ones. But I mean, it was like a kitchen like that I've never experienced. It was very fun. And I mean, having the dichotomy of like here with Roberta's, and the pizza guys coming in and out, it's just like it shows also one of the things that I love is like that kitchens have personalities. Like people are fun. Like people come from all walks of life. Like you learn a lot. Like it was such a fun time for my life working at Blanca. That's why I stayed there for so long.
The interesting thing about Blanca is that you can do anything flavor-wise there. It was probably not as confining as an EMP where 100%. I believe the clientele is expecting a foie course and they're probably expecting a caviar course, and there's probably a seared duck breast, right? Mm-hmm. But at Blanca, if you can talk a little bit, Carlo, you know, he has a lot of deep connections to sort of Asian flavor, yes. Japanese technique. But is there maybe a specific dish that you can quickly take us through, something that... was perhaps, if you can, encapsulate what was happening at Blanca when you were there.
I mean, that's tough. There's so many of them.
Yeah, just one that really sticks out to you.
There's so many of them, but one that sticks out was one that we kind of worked together on. Carlo had a really good idea of a flavor profile that he wanted to work with, and it was sunchoke, soy, olva, seaweed, and like honeycomb. And we just created this small little bite that had like green almond. It had some sunchoke puree that was like cooked in soy milk. So it kind of had some funk in it, which is something like I never would have thought to do. And then it had a little bit of like honeycomb, and then it had some like nasturtium and some dried seaweed. And just like those things like don't make sense. Like,
I was just about to say that sounds incredibly weird. It makes no sense,
but you eat it and it's just like, oh, okay. It's got creaminess. It's got a little funk. It's got texture from honeycomb. It has different texture from the olva seaweed that's dried. It has a salinity from the seaweed. It has, you know, like a little sourness from like the unripe almond. It was just, it was insane. And then like the coolest thing about that dish is that that dish evolved. Like everything that at Blanca that I've seen, especially while we were there, is the evolution of dishes. Like we were never like content. I mean, there were some dishes that were perfect. I mean, like his pasta game is, you know, obviously it speaks for itself. Like the andouille ravioli, like to the, I ate so many of those things. It's not even funny. And every time I eat one, I'm just like, God damn. I was just like, God damn, is this good? Like, this doesn't make sense. Like, it's not fair. But he did the one episode with David Kinch, and he showed the evolution of that dish, and it was so cool because I remember
on Mind of a Chef.
Yeah, like Carlo did that dish, and the way it evolved was such like, you know, it's classic what he does. I mean, it's just like the dish that I created or that we created together with Alex. That dish changed into something like even more refined, even more beautiful, and just like so different, but like still like, you know, it's so cool seeing stuff like that. Like that's like that, one of the greatest parts is like seeing how things can evolve in a kitchen.
There's sort of two types of excess that I think you find in a tasting menu. One is like the high level ingredients that are just the ingredient on the plate, which is like a more classic French style where it's like, this is caviar. This is, you know, a piece of beef with fancy stuff on top. The excessiveness at Blanca was more about like finding weird, crazy things that no one else could get their hands on. I know that there was sort of a very impressive purveyor list that Blanca used.
Oh my God, yeah.
How many purveyors were you working with at Blanca? Well, and how do you, I guess what I'm saying is like when you have no constraints, how do you self-impose those so that you don't just make a 50-item tasting menu and everything just makes the cut, you know?
I mean, there's so much in there I could talk about. like when I got brought aboard, we had a sous chef that was leaving. And he kind of passed over the purveyor list to us, and it was like 54 people long. And like at first, I was just like, "What? Why is this happening?" And then you know, when you get into it, you realize that like we got ducks from one guy. What else we got from him? Nothing. We just got ducks from him because his ducks were amazing. We get sassos from our buddy Carlo at La Pera. Like, why? Because in my opinion, that is the best chicken I've ever had in my life. So it's like we had all these purveyors who were providing certain little things, which makes it very, you know, very inundating to like to order and everything. But at the same time, it's like, you know, it's easy at a tasting menu because you do have a structure. You know how many people you're doing. So like when you can set up pars, and you can set up, you know, easy deliveries. It's one thing. But in terms of like the restraint, one thing that he being Carlo, always kind of honed in on is that, you know, we're not going to take a dish off unless we find something that's better. So that makes it also, you know, at the same time exciting, but also frustrating because it's like when you have such a good dish, like to take it off is like, it's tough. It's really tough. I mean, we had tofu on forever. Like we had the tofu dish just that went through so many iterations because it was excellent. The tofu was amazing. It was made a la minute. It was very cool. Like it was warm. It was like it was a tofu I don't think many people got to experience. And then we finally were able to take that off. And when we took that off, it was like a cheese dish of a cheese that like we were all working on. And it was like those were kind of really cool battles that we won. I don't want to say battles because that's not really the right word. But like those were cool things. Like when we got something off the menu, it was almost like a celebration because like, yeah, we made something better than something that was already so freaking good. Like it was really cool. But I mean, it's the biggest thing about a tasting menu, and especially like one like Blanc is that it had a really cool ebb and flow, like to get to satiate people, to leave them wanting more, but at the same time fulfilling them and, you know, kind of taking through a journey where they're not going to leave like rolling out the door. Like that was like the greatest thing about, Blanc, and every single person, like my parents, especially when they came and ate there, they're like, I just feel good. Like I feel very satisfied. Like I don't feel stuffed. Like I just feel good. Like you could wake up and eat breakfast the next morning. I was like, that's a cool thing about that menu. So like, you know, to be really excited about something and is like, you know, we were working at something and like, if maybe it wasn't quite right, it's fine. You know, you tuck it in your back pocket. Next year you revisit it. And that's like the great thing about cooking is that like you write it down, you have all these things. I mean, that's kind of what Ferris was, that it's just all these things that I've had ideas about, that all these things I wanted to try. I mean, we wanted to do a carrot pasta at Blanca, and we did one, and it was a very different one. It was, I think it was a farfalle pasta with rabbit, and I wanted to do a filled one, and I just couldn't get it right. And then like I spent like the better part of 3 months at Ferris trying to figure it out, trying to get it right. And like, is it right? I mean, it's good, but I'm still working on trying to make it better.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about that Sasso chicken. We're going to talk about La Turtle, and then, of course, we're going to get into Ferris, your new restaurant. Stick with us. We'll be right back here on Heritage Radio.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Welcome back to The Line. I'm here with Greg Prochel. He is the executive chef of Ferris Restaurant and the Maid Hotel. Before he opened up Ferris a couple months ago, he was at another restaurant in Manhattan called La Turtle. La Turtle became sort of notorious for this Sasso chicken, which we had been talking about before the break very briefly. You source it from Carlo, which he's a character into himself.
Oh my God, yes.
And he's got these great chickens. Tell everyone about this Sasso chicken that you were doing at La Turtle. How did you come up with that dish? And then I want you to tell me if you were happy or if you were annoyed at the at the feedback and sort of acclaim that came with that.
Well, I learned about the Sasso at Blanca. We did it there. I wanted to always do it just because, we wanted to put a chicken on the menu, and like we were throwing around the idea, like, what should we do? And then it's just like, you know what? I'm just gonna do it whole. Like, that's the best way to do it. The Sasso breed is like probably the best roasting bear just because it's like breast to like thigh ratio is like almost perfect for it. It's a really high fat bird. It brines wonderfully. It roasts wonderfully. The fat in it is amazing. The fact that, you know, like I said, the breast to thigh ratio is like, generally when you cook a chicken, obviously it's the thigh will be undercooked. So then you have to cook it more. And then the breast ends up becoming dry or overcooked. It doesn't have those problems. So, you know, we played around with it. I ate a lot of Sasso chicken during the pre-opening of Le Turtle because we had to play around with it. We tried brining it 24 hours. We tried brining it 36 hours. Then we tried brining it 48 hours. Then we actually settled on 42. For some reason, it just was the right amount. And then we decided, like, we started, so we got that down. Then we started playing on with how long are we going to dry it? You know, are we going to air dry it for 2 days, or air dry for 1 day, air dry for 3 days? We found the formula, the temperature, everything that we liked about it. And I mean, as far as chicken goes, it's a really good chicken. I mean, chicken is not the most exciting thing, but you ask a lot of people, especially a lot of chefs, you know, like deathbed meal, they want their mom's roast chicken. Like they want like a really just well done roast chicken. I mean, everything can have like, you know, tons of technique, tons of like, you know, cool ingredients or anything, but like, if you do like one thing, if you do that really well, like it's satisfying. I mean, I wanted to do it and I wanted to make a spectacle about it. I want, when you get this whole chicken, like I wanted everyone in the dining room to like stare at the table that's getting it, like make them feel really cool, make them feel really special. I mean, we're in the business. Obviously, we're giving people dinner and like, I think it's more than that. I think it's like an experience and like, we wanted to make it really fun. What came out, like, did I expect that to like go where it went? No, not at all. I mean, we were just doing a chicken that we thought was cool and we thought it was a really fun, kind of weird, slightly dangerous way of presenting it. And people really liked it. And I mean, it's funny you use the word notorious because it's, you know, I think that we had a lot of other really great things on that menu. And it was just like, oh, yeah, you work at Le Turtle, the chicken place. And I was like, yeah, but we kind of got other stuff too. But like, it's funny because that chicken also, that was like the lifeblood of that restaurant. I mean, the roasted carcasses went into all of our stocks. Our stocks went into like a kohlrabi bisque. That was like a really popular dish there. The livers went into a chicken liver mousse. That was amazing there. You know, it's funny that like that one thing kind of like saw its way through a lot of different stuff. I mean, like all of our braised meat, we use the Sasso chicken stock, which was incredibly fat and like it was super rich in umami just because of the natural like collagen in it. And it was just, it was a great product to have around. So it was like, am I mad? No, I can't be mad about that. I mean, it's like, it's funny because at Ferris, people were asking, they're like, when are you going to do a chicken? And like, there was always a plan to do a chicken and we wanted to do it differently. And we still do, and we do it some nights. Like, I mean, I got like 15 of them hanging, drying out right now that every once in a while, we just kind of pop it up. And if you're lucky enough to get one, like get one. But, you know, it's definitely not something that's like a mainstay, but we just, I mean, I think I owe it to people that really like my cooking. Like, I want to please the people that have been following me and that come here, and like we're just doing it just a little differently. Like we're doing it smoked now, which is, I think, a really cool way because it's got all that fat on it, so it really kind of picks up just a quick, we smoke it al menu right at the pass, right in front of everybody, and it is even more of a spectacle now just because it's such a small intimate space that we're working out of. But this one definitely has set off fire alarms on multiple occasions, which is not the best in a hotel. But I mean, I think it's actually, we finally got that. We got that under control now.
Going from Sue and then to executive chef at Le Turtle and now Ferris, what has been the most dramatic learning curve for you in terms of trying to find not your culinary creative voice, but your leadership voice? And what did you not feel ready for coming into the Ferris project that you're now is now kind of dawning on you?
Well, it's a very good question. I think that at Le Turtle, I was very, very stressed about stuff. I was very worried all the time. It was just my first executive gig. I was very, you know, I was very confident in my cooking, but, you know, being a leader is one thing. Like, it was very daunting, and you know, I was probably less nice than I should have been. At Ferris, that was not at all the case. I just I'm even more confident in my cooking, I think, now, confident in my leadership skill. And like, and I'm not a, you know, you say, like you mentioned before about being on the computer, but I kind of do that in my off hours. I come in, I open, I cook, I do the bread. Like, I'm prepping all day long. Like, I make every bit of pasta that comes out of that kitchen. Hence why I've been there for the last 130 days straight. It's what I want to do. I mean, and I think that's the leadership that I've always liked, is that, you know, I want to make sure no one's working harder in that kitchen than me right now. I am there all the time. Like, I will be there for people. Like, I always put everyone else in my kitchen, I think, before me, which at some point that's going to have to take a little bit of a break, because I need at least a half day off soon. But you know, I lead by example, and I think that's the most important thing. And like I said, we practice PMA in that kitchen, that positive mental attitude. We are a very fun kitchen to work in. Moods are high. Like, it's for a creative space, I think it has to be. Like, for everyone to create and for everyone to kind of be on the same page and kind of want to go after the same goal, like, you got to love what you do. I mean, it's long hours. It's daunting. It's like, you know, it's a tough life. But I mean, when you step into the foot of the kitchen, like, that was the best thing that I liked about it, is that, like, you know, nothing else matters. Like, when you're in the kitchen, like, after whatever, you had a shitty morning, you had a bad commute, you come into the kitchen and it's like, all right, we're here to work. We're here to have fun. Like, at the end of the day, we're just cooking food. We're trying to do it the best we can and try to have a lot of fun with it. But yeah, I mean, it's like, it's an enjoyable time.
You mentioned positive mental attitude and, you know, putting your employees first and keeping it sort of a fun environment, which I assume means like not as much yelling. Of course, at the end of last year and at the beginning of this year, we're addressing a lot of changes in our industry.
Yes.
Based on sexual, verbal, physical assault and harassment that's occurring across all industries. But it's been a boys' club in kitchens for a long time, and it's hopefully things are changing for the better. I'm curious, at Ferris and at the Maid Hotel, how you and the leadership team, what steps are you making now, or what did you do to foster a safe and creative work environment, so that what we've seen happen with some other restaurant groups isn't happening at your hotel and your restaurant?
Well, I mean, I don't think we really took any steps, to be honest. I just think we brought aboard just good people. I mean, that's, at the end of the day, like, that's what this comes down to, is if, like, you're a good person, you don't have to worry about anything. Like, we hire based on your skill level. That's it. I mean, that's like I said, that's one of the greatest things about the kitchen, is that, and just like what it should be when it's right, it's, you know, you have people from every background, every orientation possible. When you get in the kitchen, it's like, can you cook? Yeah, you can cook. Great. Let's cook. That's it. Like, it's very simple. That's why, like, all the things that are happening, it's very upsetting, just as a, you know, a member in this industry, is that, you know, it kind of puts us in a bad light, where when it's not, it's just like, it's a really beautiful thing to work in. It's a beautiful environment to be with all these people that are, you know, like, that are characters and have, like, their own voice and have their own, like, kind of creative and their own style. It's just like, it's a really great thing when it's great. And, like, unfortunately, we're seeing all these things about the worst case scenarios, and it's just, it's never something that we want. I mean, we're not yellers. Like, I don't yell at people. I don't like yelling. When I hear yelling, I'll hang out with my family, because they all yell all over each other so they could have a chance to speak. Like, we don't yell in the kitchen. We have music on. We have music blasting all service long. We have music blasting during prep. We just, like, you know, we pick a mood of the day and we put it on, and we just have fun. I mean, it's I don't want to say it's negligent of me to think that it's like it just doesn't happen, but like, we just don't want it to happen. We don't want that environment. We just want positivity. And I think that starts with hiring people that are A, are looking for it and making sure that nothing bad is happening. And people just are good people. I mean, Charles and me, Charles is the operator, Charles Syke. We got partnered up by one of the owners of the hotel, Sam, and we just kind of met, and immediately I was like, yeah, I'm going to work with this guy. Like, this is going to be fun. Like, this is going to be a great situation. And then he brought in his AGM, Jenny Lakin, who's doing the wine stuff, and like, she's great as well. And like, we get together, we get along so well. So I think that's just like, it's just putting good people together. I think good things are going to happen. I mean, you know, there's always the chance for something bad to happen. So we put protocol in place and we make sure we watch it. I mean, it's just being on top of everybody and just holding people accountable for what they say and their actions. It's really all it is. But I mean, we've been blessed with having really just good people that are just fun to be around.
Since you've got a bit of a late start, even yes. though you've accomplished a lot so far in your career, do you feel like you have a list of things that you're kind of checking off? And by that, I mean, are you accomplishing sort of the ultimate goal with Ferris that you've been looking for since you started cooking, or do you not know?
Well, I don't know if I know. I mean, my end goal is I want a 10-seed restaurant on a beach somewhere in the Caribbean. That's like my end goal, just like catching fish and using it. Like that will be my escape goal, my retirement plan in hopefully maybe like 20 years. I don't know. I'm not done with this industry yet. But I think that like I set plans. Like, you know, I set a 5-year plan when I started cooking. I set, a 1-year plan, a 2-year plan, and now I don't really have a plan. I just want to work in a fun place where I'm doing good food. And to be honest, the open kitchen was something I always wanted to do, because one thing I didn't like about, the finance world is I didn't get much immediate gratification. And like that was something that I immediately got once I started at Blanca, especially because I mean, there's a lot of small victories. Like, oh yeah, I just really cooked this steak really well. That's like just in this industry, like I crushed my prep today like 5 minutes faster. There's a lot of those like small little victories, but like at Blanca and like now at Ferris is like I serve something and there's someone sitting across from me and they're like yelling at me. They're like, this is so good. It's like, that's like amazing. Like it's just dinner, but like making people happy is like why we do this. You know, at the end of the day, it's hospitality. It's making people want to like come back. It's making people talk to their friends like, man, like this blood sausage I had, like I hate blood sausage. And like I hate blood sausage because the blood sausage that I grew up with was stuff that like my grandfather brought and it tasted like, you know, like blood. Like it was not good. So like I always was like, I want to make one better. But yeah, I mean, like it's so fun to like to have that open kitchen environment and have that interaction. And this is like where I wanted to be, or like this is the end. No, I mean, we're gonna keep, there needs to be a level of being, you know, of being happy with something, but at the same time, as you know, I always want more. So we're gonna keep going, Ferris. We're gonna keep evolving. We're gonna keep trying to change stuff. We're gonna keep trying to improve on everything we do. I mean, I think that's, I'm gonna always be that way until I decide, you know, maybe I just need to find that Caribbean spot. But yeah, I mean, we are always going to try to do more and try to do better. It's just because that's just who I am. And I have, like I said, I have really, really great people. I have great sous, I have great cooks, all who want to keep doing more, keep doing something amazing. So just surrounding myself with those people makes me want to do that. And it's just never not going to do that. I mean, right off the bat, we're still doing specials. We do specials right from the beginning. We offer critic specials, which I guess is not normal, which I just found out. But like, you know, that's what we want to do. We want to play, like, we're really excited about stuff. Like that's when people were talking about, you know, why we chose the name or why, you know, like what kind of cuisine it is, which I'm not gonna lie, I hate that question just because I don't know. Like the cop out is, yeah, New American. But like
which we're means, do yeah, which means nothing.
Which means not which means nothing. But like, you know, it is like pretty Japanese influenced, and like that comes directly from my time working with Carlo and Blanca. But, you know, the main thing is like, and this is something me and Charles spoke about, like at length, is like excitement. And like people are like, you can't say excitement. That's not a cuisine. But like, well, we're doing stuff we're currently excited about. Like, say we got in a sample from like Regalis is one of our best purveyors. Like they gave us a whole bunch of like this fish or like these mushrooms or like these citrus. Like we try them. We're like, damn, like these are really good. Like these are the best kumquats I've ever had. We're excited about it. Let's do something that's awesome about that. And I think that's like, I think the, like kind of the groundwork of like, you know, seasonal cuisine is that like when something comes in, you get excited about it. Like you get excited about a produce that comes in that's maybe only around for like 3 weeks. And the excitement about that is like, we got to create something. We got to get something on the plate right now. We got to do this. We have like 3 weeks. And if it takes a week to recipe test, then we're down to 2 weeks, you know? So it's like, if that, I don't think that excitement's ever going to burn out at Ferris. So we're really excited about where we're going to go. I mean, we're only 3 months old, and like we're already, I think, grooving pretty good. So we're just going to keep going and going and going.
Chef, thanks so much for joining us. Hopefully you'll get a day off sooner or later.
That's all right. That's all right.
Tell everybody where they can find Ferris in the Maid Hotel.
Ferris is at the basement at 44 West 29th Street. You can come in right through the entrance in the basement. You walk into our little oasis that's kind of tucked away, and you'll almost 100% see me standing right there at the pass.
All right, go check out Chef Greg at Ferris Restaurant and join us again every Tuesday at 11 a.m. for a new episode of The Line here on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.